Welcome to the Information Security Forum podcast. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert, and today we're bringing you one of my favorite ever interviews. Steve Durbin, Managing Director of ISF, was recently in Toronto, and he had a chance to sit down in the recording studio with Dr. Anne Kavoukian. Anne Kavoukian is recognized as one of the world's leading privacy experts. Since 2017, Kavoukian has been the distinguished expert in residence of Ryerson University's Privacy by Design Center of Excellence. In fact, she developed the concept of privacy by design and its later evolution, security by design. And in today's conversation, Dr. Kavoukian will discuss the necessity that businesses bake in security and privacy into their business plan.
Treat privacy as a business issue, not a matter of regulatory compliance. If you treat it as a business issue, you'll think, what are the gains that I can achieve by raising the bar on privacy so that it becomes a benefit for your business, not just you have to do this because you're forced to by law?
Dr. Kavoukian has much more to say, so keep listening.
So, Anne, it's great to meet you.
Many thanks.
One of the things that I really wanted to start off by talking about was these concepts that you had originally come up with some while ago now, privacy by design, security by design. Just tell me a little bit about those two. What do they actually mean? What are the implications?
Privacy by design, I came up with that 20 years ago, believe it or not. So when I was privacy commissioner, I was atypical because I'm not a lawyer. I'm a psychologist. I studied psychology and the law. So I bring a very different perspective to it. So I didn't want to just rely on regulatory compliance after the fact to protect privacy. That would offer remedies once privacy was breached. There was a data breach, a privacy infraction, then you offer a remedy. But to me, that was too little, too late. I wanted a model of prevention, much like a medical model of prevention, where you try to prevent the harms from arising. So that's why I came up with privacy by design, which is all about proactively, upfront, embedding privacy protective measures into the design of your operations. Bake it into the code, bake it into your data architecture so you can avoid the privacy harms. And that's how it originated. Right. And of course, security is essential. I always remind people that privacy subsumes a much broader set of protections than security alone. But in this day and age of daily cybersecurity attacks and hacks, if you don't have a strong foundation of security from end to end with full lifecycle protection, you're not going to have any privacy. So you must have both privacy and security embedded in design.
You say you came up with that 20 years ago. You know, I think that that's something we've probably been struggling with still as an industry over that period of time. And certainly in the interaction that I have with senior executives and boards, I think they tend to fall into a number of different camps. There are those that clearly understand it. They've got this line of sight, if you like, between the importance of it and what they do. But then there are others for whom perhaps it isn't quite so clear. Would you agree with that?
I totally agree. And in fact, I do a lot of public speaking and consulting. Companies invite me to speak to them, to their boards. And most of the time when I go in, there's sort of a negative vibe in the room because they're thinking privacy stifles creativity and innovation and business interests. And I ask them, give me 20 minutes. Let me explain to you how privacy actually breeds innovation, creativity, prosperity, because it allows for that blue sky thinking that you need to come up with great business ideas. And privacy by design is all about privacy and business interests, privacy and security, not the zero-sum model of one versus the other. So you have to have both. And when I talk about the innovation it can render, I always like to use the example of Steve Jobs, the brilliant Steve Jobs who created Apple. He used to buy a new white Mercedes, the exact same model, every 6 months, less a day.
Right.
You might say, why would he do that? Because in California at that time, you didn't have to get a license plate number, a license plate on a new car you purchased. You had 6 months. He didn't want a license plate. I mean, he didn't want to be tracked. He didn't want anything linked to him. So he would take it in, buy a new one every 6 months, less a day.
Right.
And he never had a license plate number. It was never tracked. I mean, it's that kind of crazy thinking that breeds innovation. Mm-hmm. I should add that after he died, they changed the law in California. So, but the point is, I tell people, not only does it breed innovation and creativity because people can think out of the box, but it also embeds trust in your operations. Right now, there's such a trust deficit. Mm-hmm. If you want the trust of your customers, build a trusted business relationship by telling them how much you respect their privacy, how much you protect their information, and how you will consult with them if there's a new purpose that arises, you'd like to use their information from, you will come back to them and seek their positive consent. It builds so much trust and it attracts new opportunity. It preserves the customers you have. Their loyalty grows. It's a total win-win. You gain a competitive advantage by building in privacy into your design. And when they hear that, everything changes just like this. All of a sudden, they're for privacy because they don't view it as a negative anymore. You have to understand the benefits that will accrue to you and to your business if you frame it in that manner.
No, I'm really pleased to hear you say that because one of the things that I think certainly set me down that road was actually the General Data Protection Regulation.
Yes.
In the European Union.
Yes.
And, you know, when I first looked at that and I thought of some of the challenges that from a business perspective, it was, well, wow, this is going to be pretty seismic in terms of the way that it's going to change the way that we have to go about doing business. But it's this trust piece. And it isn't a huge shift. It's just flipping a switch that
says,
you know, we need to be communicating on a much more regular basis,
yes,
on a much more transparent basis with the people that we're collecting data from,
yes,
and demonstrating the benefit of it. If we can't do that, then actually there's probably something wrong with our business model rather than anything else. And I think as soon as you get that piece, as you say, the world changes.
I couldn't agree with you more. If I can just add, privacy is all about control, personal control relating to the uses of your personal information. And context is key. That's why it's so important. Only the individual knows the sensitivity or lack thereof associated with certain information. They have to be the ones to make the decisions. And the GDPR, as you mentioned, which was introduced over a year ago in the European Union, that preserves control in a big way. It brings it to everyone's attention and it raises the bar dramatically. And since they kindly included my Privacy by Design framework into the GDPR, that's the highest level of privacy you can achieve. And it's all about, as you said, being transparent, involving the individuals whose information you're using and in what manner. And it's just a seismic change in the way people view privacy, and it's having a global effect because countries all around the world are now trying to mirror the GDPR because they want to engage in trade and do business with the EU. So it's really becoming a win-win.
It is. And I think we've, as you say, it's only been around for 12 months. And I think a lot of the focus, perhaps unfortunately, has been more certainly in the press on some of the fines that might be levied and,
yes,
and this kind of thing. And for me, that's probably emphasizing the wrong element of it.
You know,
would you agree?
I do agree. The only positive about the fines is it makes it serious. Mm-hmm. For businesses, you have to do this. You can't keep ignoring these things. But the benefits are enormous. And for individuals relating to their information, there's data portability. You can move your data. There's the right to be forgotten in mm-hmm. terms of data erasure. There's so much in there. There's privacy as the default, which is the second of the seven foundational principles of privacy by design. That is huge because it flips everything on its head. It tells people, we no longer expect you to search through all the legalese in the terms of service and the privacy policy to find the opt-out box, negative consent, say, do not use my information for any purposes other than the primary purpose of the data collection. That's gone out because, I mean, really, who does that? No one has time to do that. It takes hours to do that.
Right.
Privacy is the default, is the exact opposite. No, we don't expect you to do that. We give you privacy automatically. It's the default setting. It's embedded in our operations. We can only use your information for the purposes intended. That is such a game changer. It takes the pressure off of people to be the ones to figure out how to protect their privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And it places the onus on companies and organizations that you've got to get serious about this and restrict your uses of the information to that which the individual consented to. Huge game change.
Right. Does it impose an additional burden, do you think, on organizations from a compliance, from a cost, from a resource perspective?
I'm going to be honest with you. It does. There's no question. A lot of people talk about this is a bureaucratic nightmare and there's so many things we have to do. It is true that at the beginning, once you reframe things in your organization, once you have that new perspective in place, then it's easy on a go-forward basis. But you will be required to do things. I mean, if you use information for 100 different purposes that were never intended, you can't do that anymore.
Right.
So, yes, you have to change your operations, but the benefits also accrue because your customers will thank you for it and you will attract new customers and new opportunity. So I always try to frame it as a positive. Yes, there's some work to be done at the beginning, but then once you have that in place, you will be rewarded for doing this.
Mm-hmm. You made a point earlier that I just want to come back to because I think it's really important for people listening to this. That was around it being a competitive differentiator.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about that.
You know, I did that. I came up with that. Even when I was privacy commissioner, I was privacy commissioner of Ontario, Canada for 3 terms, like 17 years. And as I mentioned, I'm not a lawyer. I have a different perspective on this. So I didn't want, even when I was a commissioner, I didn't want people to rely on regulatory compliance, mm-hmm. which is always after the fact.
Right.
I used to say, and I still do, treat privacy as a business issue, not a matter of regulatory compliance. If you treat it as a business issue, you'll think, what are the gains that I can achieve by raising the bar on privacy so that it becomes a benefit for your business, not just you have to do this because you're forced to by law.
Mm-hmm.
I have found when people have to do it and they're just following the law to be compliant with the regulations, they do the minimum possible. So yes, they're following the law. I want them to do more.
Right.
I always want to raise the bar. And when you can present it to business that there's a benefit to them, which there clearly is, then they embrace this. And I always tell companies who do privacy by design, I say, don't keep it to yourself. Shout it from the rooftops. Tell your customers the lengths you're going to protect their privacy. That's when all the benefits kick in and the trusted business relationship develops.
And I think if we look forward to the way that technology is changing, society is changing, you know, that's going to become much more important. I'm thinking in particular of the whole sort of move towards smart environment, whether
yes.
it be in the home, whether it be smart cities. Clearly,
yes.
lots of advantages in that. But the real, you know, fundamental challenge, I think, in all of that is the data collection. You
yes.
know, what do you actually need to be collecting? How do you store it? How do you use it? And this issue of consent. Again, so I'm sure
yes.
you've got some views on that.
I always tell people, don't bring connected devices into your home. They're not ready for prime time. So Internet of Things, the Alexas, which mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard about. My God, the number of breaches, data breaches, of information from these Alexa devices, Echo, et cetera, in your home. You wouldn't believe the number of calls I get. A few months ago, there was an issue. So Alexa records everything that's taking place,
right.
and people forget it's on. I always tell people, at least turn it off when you're having private, intimate conversations
mm-hmm.
with, you know, your spouse, your children. And when they don't do that, there are all kinds of stories that I've heard about. One was this couple was having a very heart-to-heart discussion about their marital problems,
mm-hmm.
and Alexa was on. The next morning, she gets a call, the wife from one of her girlfriends, who says, I didn't know you were having so many problems in your marriage. What's going on? And she says, we haven't told anybody. How did you hear that? Alexa sent that to her. She was one of the contacts of this couple. I have no idea how this works.
Right.
But can you imagine? That's how she got this information. The original person was horrified
mm-hmm.
because obviously that was never intended. I mean, it's clearly an egregious use. And things like that happen. It's not the only story. There was this other story. This little girl is talking to Alexa and says, Alexa, I really want this beautiful dollhouse. And she was looking at it on the web or something.
Mm-hmm.
Next day, there's a knock on the door. The mother goes to the door. It's a beautiful dollhouse that's been delivered. And somehow, Alexa ordered the dollhouse, delivered it to them, and of course, charged it to the
right.
mother who wasn't aware. I'm just giving these examples to show that this stuff is not ready for prime time. Privacy and security are just simply overlooked in the creation of these devices. It's like IoT is like the Wild West. It's running out the door at such ridiculous speeds. It's not ready. Be careful.
Right. And it's interesting, you know, California has introduced this upcoming legislation anyway around security by
yes.
design in IoT devices.
Yes.
And, you know, that's fine going forward. But I think people often forget that there are billions of these things that are all out there in the wild now already. And it's very, very difficult to turn the clock back and then to control some of those things. And as you rightly point out, they were never designed with either security or privacy in mind. I suppose one of the counters to that from big tech would be, well, you can switch it off. You know, you are in control. We provide a box, a tool, a piece of software, whatever it is, that you can manage. If you don't manage it, then that's not a big tech problem. That's an individual problem, right?
You know, I've heard that many times, and I understand that. I mean, you can turn Alexa off, of course. The reality is, people forget. People mm-hmm. don't think about it. And many people, you know, love Alexa. They get lots of information from it. So they tend to leave it on. But they don't make the associations of what could go wrong in terms of information that is very personal, intimate, etc., going out the door. So these are the cautions. I just like to remind people. It's really hard, though, in this day and age, like you said, there's so much going on in terms of tech, to remember everything, to place the problem on the user. It's up to you to protect your privacy and remember to do all these things. I just think that's too onerous a requirement. And that's why I love it when people start embracing privacy by design. It takes the pressure off of the user mm-hmm. and the companies start delivering privacy. And they do get rewarded for that.
Yeah. And I suppose, you know, Alexa is probably one of the easier things to turn off,
yes.
right? I mean, I'm thinking of some of the other things that happen with that perhaps users simply don't know about. Tracking, for instance, you know, with your mobile phone, the ability for the phone company to know exactly where you are at any single point in time. And depending on what you do, whether you're an Apple user or Android, doesn't really matter. The linkage through the apps and what the apps are doing and so on. And clearly, we're a million miles from privacy by design when it comes to those sorts of things.
No, you're right. And things like the smartphones, et cetera, need to know your location. It pings off of cell phone towers, and that's how these things work. The problem with that is now the police are engaging in these devices, this technology called stingrays, and they impersonate a cell phone tower. So they collect people's information in a given area, mm-hmm. and they do searches based on this, all without a warrant. And when the CBC here in Canada outed the RCMP last year and said, you're collecting all this information from thousands of people, their cell phones, and you don't have a warrant. And they said, well, we're looking for this bad guy.
Right.
And so CBC says, okay, well, did you find him? No, we didn't. But you got all the information from all these other people's cell phones, and you're deleting that now, right? Not so much. Mm-hmm. It might come in useful. I mean, this is the problem. And who's going to give up their smartphones? You know, nobody.
Yeah.
And understandably, I mean, they're invaluable. So we have to find ways. And I'm optimistic that going forward, we'll find more and more ways to protect the data. Mm-hmm. But it's not there yet.
It's interesting, this issue of data protection, because one of the things I've been very critical of is we are effectively building up these vats of data. If I'm a cyber criminal, or if I'm interested in getting
yes.
hold of some really interesting information, I now know exactly where to go.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm sorry, I don't subscribe to the view that you can protect these things, because there's no such thing as 100% security, right?
Yes, yes.
And so we then get into discussions around things like encryption and storage and all of that good stuff. But again, that has to be designed in from the start,
yes,
right? And if we
absolutely.
Aren't thinking along those lines,
and
that's the problem.
That's why the design is so critical mm-hmm. for all of these going forward. It's absolutely essential. And I just urge people to ask lots of questions before they purchase these products or these devices. And you're right. It's everywhere. How do you control this? This is going to take time. I want to be very clear. And I often talk about the myth of zero risk. So
right.
we can't have the expectation that you can eliminate all risk. It's just that doesn't exist anywhere in life. But you can minimize the risk dramatically. So these huge centralized databases with all of this information in it, my hope is we're going to steer in the direction of decentralization. Last year, Tim Berners-Lee, who created the World Wide mm-hmm. Web, went public and he said, I'm horrified at what I've created. Centralized databases full of personal information from the web, which are used to track people, engage in surveillance. Horrific. I'm walking away from that. I'm decentralizing. He has a new model called Solid. So more and more, we're all encouraging organizations to deal with decentralized pockets of information, where individuals can control their own data, which can reside in a secure enclave in a cloud, and it's under the control of that individual, as opposed to having this honeypot that companies like Google and Facebook have, and then they do whatever they want with it. They share it with third parties without your consent, and you have no control. We have to go away from that. I see more and more examples of that. Mm-hmm. So I think in the next 2 to 3 years, you will see an acceleration of that model where information will be encrypted, it'll be stored in a classified manner, decentralized manner, so that it won't be available to the Googles and Facebooks the way it has been.
And that, of course, is going to require them to change their business models, right?
Indeed, absolutely. But that's where the positive could come in. Mm-hmm. That's my hope, is that you entice people to your business, whatever you're doing, and you let them know how much you protect their privacy and how much you value having them as a customer. People love that. People want to work with organizations they can trust. And now we have to build the trust, which is totally lacking in the Facebooks, et cetera. And that's what I'm hoping we can do. As soon as we get some alternative, viable alternatives to Facebook, for example, people will move because no one is happy with what's happening with their information.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, going back into that whole smart city and environment, lots of benefits, obviously, within a smart city environment. But tell me a little bit about that. You made the point earlier that you'd recently resigned here in Canada from a particular initiative, Sidewalk, being involved in that. But tell me a little bit more about that.
The position I took with Sidewalk and with others is when you're creating a smart city, the technology's on 24/7, all the sensors, et cetera. Your data is being collected constantly. And in that kind of structure, people don't have an opportunity to consent or revoke consent in terms of the collection of their personal information. So I said, that's why we must de-identify data at source, meaning the minute the sensor collects some information, it's stripped of all personal identifiers. And then you will have data, which will be very valuable, but it won't have privacy concerns associated with it because it will all the personal information will have been stripped from it. Mm-hmm. And we can do this with very high level of reliability. You can do it so that the data is protected 95% of the time, so only an error rate of 0.05%. And the odds of your data being re-identified under that construct, it's less than the odds of being hit by lightning when you go outside when it's raining. You know, very, right. very good odds. We can do this, but we have to insist upon it at the time, right up front. And we have to insist upon that across all businesses involved in this. Sidewalk Labs had agreed with me that they would do de-identifying data at source. I was very pleased with that because they hired me to embed privacy by design into this smart city they were creating. But when they created something called a civic data trust, which opened up the governance of the information to multiple parties, including different businesses, IT companies, levels of government, etc., they said, we will encourage everyone to de-identify data at source, but we can't make them do that, of course. Mm-hmm. And that's when I knew I could no longer work with them because you cannot leave this as a choice. You have to dictate it because everyone wants personally identifiable data. It's a treasure trove.
Yeah.
So you leave this, make your own decision. It's not going to happen. The good news is I'm now working directly with Waterfront Toronto, who is the organizing body here who hired Sidewalk. And the beauty of that is Waterfront Toronto contacted me as soon as I resigned, and the board contacted me and they said, come work with us. Mm-hmm. We believe in anonymizing the data at source. We want to make this a reality. So that's the positive end. But we must de-identify information, strip the personal identifiers. Otherwise, you're going to have people's personal information floating around out there. You can't have a smart city of privacy any longer, which was my dream. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a smart city of surveillance. And that's the existing model out east, Shanghai, Dubai, etc. It's all about tracking people and their activities. And we can't have that here.
Right. You make a very, very valid point that the technology exists to be able to de-identify.
Exactly.
And so, you know, if you really are committed to privacy by design, why would you not use it would be the question, right?
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Let's sort of shift gears a little bit here. One of the challenges, I think, as well, surrounding privacy is that for a lot of people, they simply don't appreciate what it is that they're sharing. So I'm thinking in particular of children, of college students and so on. You know, I saw some data just the other day that was saying that, you know, the typical 9-year-old is spending something ridiculous like 7 hours a day connected to a device. Well, imagine all of the information that's being exchanged in that. And for me, it's about education. It's about starting in the schools, primary schools, if not earlier than that, to really, I think, help people understand the impact of what it is that they're actually doing. And it takes us into a whole range of different areas from you know, social well-being and societal issues. But is that something that you're increasingly concerned about?
Without a doubt. And young children, especially, you're talking about 9-year-olds, et cetera. I mean, having an appreciation for privacy, certainly you can't expect that. They just haven't had the life experiences to understand why you have to protect that. But I want to make it clear that it's a myth that young people generally don't care about privacy. They care deeply about privacy. Dana Boyd at New York University, she's done so much research on this, showing that kids, I mean, they're not kids, but young people aged, you know, 16 to 24, I believe, is the age group she was looking at, care deeply about privacy, but it may not appear as if they do because they don't have, you know, economic interests. They're not working yet and it's a different world. But do they ever know how to keep information from their parents, for example? Mm-hmm. I mean, things that are sensitive to them and they're born digital. They know how to protect this data and keep it away from people who they don't want to see it. So I think they have an intense understanding of it and it just isn't visible to adults who have economic interests and employment concerns, et cetera. It's a different mindset as to what they want to protect. But boy, do they know how to protect that. So that gives me hope that as they're growing and entering into the workforce, et cetera, they will still be concerned about their privacy and they will go to great lengths to protect it.
But that's when we get into this sort of, I hesitate to use the term sort of an age group clash. But one of the things that certainly I think is a big challenge is we bring younger people into the workforce. We train them effectively through schools, colleges, universities, that sharing of information, you know, collaborative working is the way to go. Then we put them into a work environment and we close all of that down because for whatever reason, you know, that is no longer appropriate. And so we're sending mixed messages. And for an organization to change is very, very difficult. And so I think we're going to enter into an era where we've got some of these sort of newer organizations that get it. And again, those that are going to struggle. And when we look at, you know, skill shortage and that kind of thing, for me, that really is a competitive differentiator. The ability to be able to have, you know, cross age groups collaborating effectively in your organization is, for me anyway, fundamental to business success going forward.
I couldn't agree more. And when I talk to businesses, I try to differentiate what information they should feel very free to share and collaborate and grow versus the protecting. So the distinction between personally identifiable data versus, you know, you've got a group of techies and they're working on machine learning and artificial intelligence, and you want them to share and collaborate. And that's how the brilliant ideas come forward. There's no problem there because you're not dealing with personal information. I put the walls up when the data are personally identifiable and linked to identifiable individuals. I always tell businesses, that's where your concerns have to be. And you can explain this to your employees, that you want collaboration. I always tell companies, get rid of the silos. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't have legal over here and policy here and tech over here, and they're not talking to each other. You have to have that kind of communication, because that also builds for much greater privacy, because then you can embed privacy up front into all of these operations in a way that they can understand it. But I make it clear, this will not impede your business interests, because that personally identifiable data often relates just to employees and certain aspects of their work. The actual material that you're working on, you want collaboration on that. And it's not that hard to do. Once I explain this to companies, they get it. And they say, so you're not talking about putting the walls up everywhere. Of course not. You want that kind of interaction to develop the brilliant ideas that will be forthcoming. You do it in a way that doesn't deal with personally identifiable data. It's not that hard.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are people listening to this who are thinking, you know, I understand all that Anne and Steve have just been talking about, but where do I start? You know, I'm a privacy officer, maybe I'm an information security officer in a business that doesn't subscribe to the view we've just been talking about.
Yes.
Any advice for them? Where do they start?
I always tell them to develop a data map.
Right.
Whenever I go to a company, I say, do you have a data map? And they look at me like I'm crazy. And what I mean by that is just track what personally identifiable data comes into your company from your customers, for example. You collect it, and at the first instance, you might have collected it with the consent of the customer, and it's all proper. But then often that data flows to other departments throughout your organization, and you have to be able to view to see how to navigate where it flows to and whether additional consents are required or the uses are authorized. You have to be able to track the data flow of personally identifiable data. And then it makes it really easy. And then you can deal with the business you're engaged in without concern because you've got those privacy issues addressed.
Right. And any tips for engaging better with business leaders? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, I'm the chief marketing officer and I've got a whole range of different information here that is very, very valuable in the way in which I'm taking some of my products to market. And suddenly you turn up and say to me, well, hang on a minute, Steve, no, you can't use some of that. I mean, that's a big one, right?
I always say, look, privacy is not anti-marketing, it's pro-choice. And I, believe it or not, every year at the annual conference of the Canadian Marketing Association, they invite me as their keynote.
Right.
And I always start by saying, I'm sure I'm the least popular speaker here today. And they, fortunately, they laugh and they say, no, but we know we've got to do this. And I try to present it to them in a way that makes it a positive. Yes, you have vast amounts of information, but the last thing you want is any kind of data breach that might place all that information in harm's way and affect your business. I mean, so many businesses, when there are data breaches now, they're not just lawsuits, they're class action lawsuits. This can put you out of business.
Mm-hmm.
So think hard up front. You have personally identifiable data. You want to market to individuals. So with their consent, you can send them whatever you want because they're consenting to it. They're willing recipients. And often you will be far more likely to get consent if you tell them, we want to send you marketing information, but we don't share your information with a host of third parties unknown that you haven't consented to.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to send you information. If you have a problem with that, let us know. But we want to have your business. We want to have a dialogue with you. Customers love that. They just want the transparency to know what to expect. And there's no problem getting marketing information from companies you have an interest in. You know, I know this is silly, but I love shoes.
Right.
And I love getting information relating to the shoes that I like to buy. And if there's a sale or something to that effect, great, I'm in. So just allow people to make choices as to what information they really want to receive from marketers and then tailor your needs to that. So we can make this all work. You just have to address it up front.
It's all about relevance, isn't it? And
yes.
I think that by getting that deeper understanding, effectively, of the potential customer or existing customer, actually we're ticking a lot of marketing boxes because that is really what the marketeer is after.
Yes.
How do I tailor better my
yes.
proposition to my target customer?
And that benefits you.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
And remember, privacy by design is all about making things win-win. It's about multiple gains. It's not an either-or win-lose proposition ever, because when you do win-lose, I always say it always leads to everyone losing. So if you can frame it as multiple gains for all parties involved, then you're going to be far more likely to engage in it and your customers are going to be happier with you. And that's where the win-win comes in.
Fantastic. Thanks very much indeed, Anne.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Anne Kavoukian and Steve Durbin. We'll be back again soon with more valuable conversations about cybersecurity. In the meantime, if you're enjoying this podcast, not only do we hope you subscribe, but we hope you'll share it with other people you think would benefit. And we hope to see you on the ISF website, securityforum.org, which is full of research, practical tools, and guidance that address current topics and are used by all the ISF members to overcome the wide-ranging information security challenges that impact their businesses today. We're on Twitter at Security Forum if you want to reach out through social media. And we'll be back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening.